Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday and 30 minutes beyond the headlines with sharp insights and expert analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping the future. Whether you're tuning in live or catching us a little later, stay ahead with stories that matter. And coming up on the program, the great swinging tightrope that is Budget 2025. New data on the real impact of Black Friday, South Africa's new earnings threshold. Is the balance sufficient for both labor and business? And are our universities producing the right type of lawyers for the country's unique needs? It's Wednesday, the 12th of March. Now, it might be a stretch, but many people think that South Africa is simply running out of money. That's the brutal reality that the Finance Minister, Enoch Godongwana, faces as he prepares to deliver the budget speech a little later today. Now, the country's debt is soaring. Tax revenues are under increasing pressure. There's also growing debate over whether VAT should be hiked to plug the fiscal hole. Meanwhile, as you well know, government is juggling urgent spending needs from social grants to infrastructure, while businesses and consumers struggle under the weight of high interest rates and slow growth. So let's try and cut through the spin ahead of the budget today. Let's get some indication of the real economic risks and priorities. We're joined by Dr. Ntabiseng Moleko, who's an economist and senior lecturer at the Stellenbosch Business School. Dr. Moleko, let's start with the very hard truth. I'll put it to you bluntly. Do you think South Africa is broke or facing that?
Well, what we have seen is that Treasury has come forward to just indicate that the issue of the budget balancing is problematic, primarily because of the social relief distress grant ruling that has put them out of pocket in the sense that it wasn't budgeted for, and the allocation and timing of it was for temporary relief. And so the court ruling makes them now what they have to do is a budget for 191 billion additional allocation to a budget vote that hadn't initially been budgeted for. So this means that the increase in VAT and what we are seeing in attempt to increase revenue generation is primarily linked to that shortfall or that finance gap.
This lack of planning is very worrying, isn't it?
I don't know if it's lack of planning. I think the ruling and the judgment has forced Treasury and the arm of Treasury to consider, you know, the allocation. It wasn't necessarily in the medium-term budget policy statement. Had the ruling been made then, I think it would have enabled a different type of a response. So I think the timing of the ruling is a factor. And also you look at the historical 6 months ago budget, what Treasury had budgeted for, and the adjustments obviously are done in light of collections and whether or not the targeted projections of what SARS was going to be able to collect has been realized.
How helpful is an increase in VAT going to be then in this respect, in terms of plugging that gap?
So VAT would have collected an additional just under 60 billion for this financial year. This is what Treasury has estimated. However, the weak economy or the cost of living crisis and the weak growth means that there are other pressures that would mean that the VAT hike hasn't necessarily taken into consideration because of the socioeconomic situation many households are finding themselves, particularly with disposable income being compressed and other priorities taking the fore. So I think that the VAT increase, the concern that many economists and also political constituencies have said is that a VAT hike may not yield the revenue collection. I think this is the emphasis maybe made even by the revenue authority, that the VAT hike may not, or revisioning of the VAT hike, may not yield the outcomes. I think that the issue here is tax hikes, whether it's corporate tax, whether it's VAT hikes, or whether it's excise tax hikes, are not going to yield the type of collection and revenue that you ordinarily would have had 3-4 years ago, because the economy hasn't grown, because the conditions are not growing, because companies are actually closing down, because SMMEs and the number of SMEs to tax have actually reduced. And so you're finding that there's a constrained economy and a constrained environment. The number of households where people are working has shrunk. You have more unemployed people rather than personnel whom you can actually have a wider tax base. So the issue is that the pie is actually getting smaller rather than the cake widening. So I think the challenge with a VAT or a hiking strategy is that it's not resolving the low growth problem, and it's not resolving, and you can't out-tax low performance of growth. You can't out-tax the population because you're unable to expand economic activity and economic output. And I think the question now is, how do we propel in the short term and also in the medium and long term economic activity so that we can actually have a wider pie to actually collect from?
So in terms then of stimulating economic growth, what does economic theory say? What's the best way to approach that?
Well, there's various factors in the short term, in the long term. In the long term, human resource development or capital investment in human capacity is usually the best strategy, i.e. put money in education, put money in skills and training, make sure that your schooling outcomes, your curriculum development is innovative and actually propels, you know, the supply of what the economy demands in the long term. So all the education initiatives are very much in line with that. I think on the other end, when you look at different growth theories, you look at the investment, you know, in capital so that you can have productive activities. So that will propel not only your labor productivity, but also your total factor productivity. And that enhances efficiency in both your, whether it's manufacturing, whether it's your tertiary services, or whether it's your primary sector. So you've got to be innovative where you're able to translate your input into output at a much lower level of cost, and ensure that you use lower level of input to translate those to economic activity and output. So what this primarily means is that we've got to make capital and liquidity available to SMMEs. We've got to make it cheaper in terms of the cost of borrowing so that more can access these, so that you can have a wider growth of subsectors in the economy, and you can actually enhance your total factor productivity in the country. I think the second aspect where you're able to quicken, you know, the rate at which we grow is you target sectors that are labor absorptive, where people can access disposable income, but also you begin to see, you know, the widening of the net in some of these economic subsectors. I think the last point is many of our economies are depressed because of economic investment in infrastructure. Whether you're looking at railways, network industries, whether you're looking at roads in maybe rural areas, you've got to widen, you know, economic activity by investing in capital. Marginal productivity of capital is enhanced when you look at the theories around that. So there's a couple of things that can be done, but I think it requires urgency, it requires innovation, and it requires the state to coordinate itself better so that you can enhance efficiencies. So there's a couple of things that can be done in the immediate term, and in the short to medium to long term.
Thank you very much indeed for those views. That's Dr. Ntabiseng Moleko, economist, senior lecturer at the Stellenbosch Business School.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
The new Black Friday index from Eccentric Payment Systems confirms that Black Friday through to Cyber Monday remains the most powerful retail period of the year, outpacing the entire holiday season in growth and transaction volume. But is this good news for retailers, or just a sign that consumers are shifting spending rather than increasing it? Rory Bosman is Chief Sales and Marketing Officer at Eccentric and joins me now. Rory, a very warm welcome. So your report, I think, predictably confirms the dominance of Black Friday. But what's the answer to the question that I've just raised? Are retailers actually winning, or is it just simply a shift of sales from December to earlier in November?
Hi, Jeremy, and thanks for having me. No, we're most definitely seeing a win for retailers who capitalize on the Black Friday to Cyber Monday time period. Our index effectively indicates this and looks to score it, showing the share of total holiday spend which is effectively the period from beginning of November right up until Christmas Eve, effectively. So that's sort of 7-week period. And how much of that spend shifts to the shorter period between and including Black Friday to Cyber Monday. And over the last 2 years, we've seen a definite growth in that period as a percentage of total holiday spend.
So this might seem like a very black and white question, but given the data then, and it's now empirical, you've got the numbers, should retailers be focusing more on Black Friday than Christmas sales then?
That is a very good question. The question is that, that's the shift that's taken place, and that more spend, both online and in-store, has shifted away from the final rush before Christmas, so Christmas Eve and the 23rd of December, to that Cyber Monday to Black Friday period. Yes, is the short answer.
So you also talk in your report about omni-channel integration, a big theme in the findings. Explain to me what that is and whether adaptation from retailers is fast enough to fully capitalize on the concept.
All right, so the first thing is that we see a significant lead in e-commerce transactions. So there are a couple of reasons for that. And to your question around omnichannel, this is an important component or precursor. Everybody's familiar with significant growth and wins in e-commerce shopping since lockdown, both for fast-moving consumer goods as well as bigger ticket items. So there's a growing culture and confidence amongst consumers in shopping online. That said, what we define omnichannel as being is the in-store and online integration of experience for the consumer. And this is seen as absolutely key, and the data indicates that it's absolutely key to growing shopping experience, or growing the value of shopping experiences for consumers, and directly sort of fuels the numbers that we're seeing in the shift from Black Friday to Cyber Monday. What it effectively means is that the experience of the consumer is the same both in store and online, and that covers a few things. So when we look at promotions, buying history, order and payment flow and ease of use, that those things are all consistent, and obviously the accessibility to products, so that inventory is equally available to all. That's what we define as an omnichannel experience, and that is materially important to retailers.
I wonder if there's a little bit of false flagging here, though, Rory. We do know that South African consumers are under increasing financial pressure. That's not necessarily going to ease up. So broadly then, do you think Black Friday benefits the economy, or is the deep discounting that is available during that time period simply eating into the profit of retailers?
I think it's probably a mixture, a combination. You know, when we see the value, we measure two key metrics, the value of transactions, so the in rand terms, as well as the volume of transactions, which gives us an indication of basket sizes and what people are buying, as well as how frequently and their preferred channel. And we've seen two things in comparing the 2024 index to 2023. And one is a growth in spend collectively. So more money was spent in that sort of Black Friday window than in the previous year, and also across the entire holiday period. Now, that obviously inflation accounts for some of that, but it doesn't account necessarily for the volume of transactions. What it means is that people have more money and are spending more, and that they are waiting and optimizing that spend, waiting for sort of dated or personalized promotions and pricing drivers during that period, which indicates a positive impact on the economy as a whole.
Let me pivot slightly. The role of artificial intelligence and data-driven personalization, that's obviously playing a more important role in helping retailers optimize a Black Friday and Cyber Monday strategy, surely.
Yeah, absolutely. It speaks to the sort of personalization that we're talking about. Any retailer will emphasize how important it is to know your customer, and knowing the customer's profile, their spending habits, their wants and needs, and being able to impact on decision making at the time of purchase is material. And we're seeing a lot of point of sale software vendors now, especially in the enterprise space, that are facilitating this for retailers by enabling AI-driven promotions at the point of sale. So I'm vacillating between two products. It's clear that from looking at that, I'm looking at both or alternating between the two of them, being able to incentivize that consumer one way or the other through AI-driven promotions is having an enormous difference and will continue to make an enormous difference on buying decisions.
Such fascinating insights at the start of this year. Rory Bosman, thank you very much indeed. Chief Sales and Marketing Officer at Ecentric Payment Systems. I appreciate your time. Thank you.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
South Africa's new earnings threshold is set to rise on the 1st of April, bringing a 2.9% increase in line with inflation. Now, government says this adjustment will provide relief for businesses while still protecting workers. But is this a genuine lifeline or just a symbolic move that barely scratches the surface of all of our economic challenges? I'm in conversation now with Jonathan Goldberg, Chairman of Global Business Solutions. I want to discuss whether this adjustment is enough to truly support businesses and workers or if deeper reforms are needed. So, Jonathan, first of all, as I've mentioned and welcome to you, the increase modest and inflation-linked, says government. Is it enough, though, to make any meaningful impact?
Well, I think from a business perspective, you don't want the threshold going too high because above the threshold, you know, again, if the threshold goes too high, then a number of people come into minimum protections. We have a Basic Conditions of Employment Act where majority of this is affected by the Basic Conditions of Employment Act. So the higher the threshold, of course, the more people are then included into having ordinary hours of work dictated to not more than 45, as an example. So you want an inflation-related increase. Trade unions have pushed for a higher increase to get the threshold higher so more workers are then included into these basic conditions of employment. For business, of course, there'd be a cost to that. So the 2.9%, which is 6 weeks before the implementation of the national minimum wage increase of inflation of 2.9%, is a good, reasonable increase in the context of moving the threshold not too much up, but in line with inflation.
So we've hit something of a sweet spot then, but some people do say that this is simply a short-term fix, that deeper structural reform is needed by government. Is that a fair assessment, do you think? And if so, what further implementation or remedies are needed?
I think the Labour Relations Act, if you read the NEDLAC report, the Labour Relations Act amendments and that have just come through the NEDLAC process go some way to doing that. The proposals agreed on by business and labour in that report indicate that, for instance, there'd be a free period of employment for the first 3 months of employment, that you could then check people out, not go through probation, and then terminate provided it wasn't discriminatory. So I think there are a number of amendments, exemption for small businesses from bargaining council agreement for 2 years. I think those would go a long way to easing up employment and letting employers take a chance with people. I think what employers are saying is that it's just too onerous to dismiss people. And again, in the Code of Good Practice released by the Department of Employment and Labour recently, there are a number of amendments that ease up this whole inquisitorial, magisterial type case that you have to follow for a dismissal of a person. So it's back to a simple inquiry around those. I think those are going to have a big impact on the labour market, and the faster they go to Parliament get passed, the better.
We've also got to factor in, surely, though, growing economic uncertainty worldwide, talk of a potential recession in the United States. Locally, do you think this could change or even discourage businesses from hiring full-time staff that would lead to more casualization, which comes with its own set of difficulties?
Well, I think the first thing is that so long as we keep the threshold in line with the inflation and not above it, so some of the trade unions are pushing for a big, big increase here, which would really have a big negative impact on the labour market, because then you're putting a number of employees into these basic terms of conditions of employment, which could be costly. And the logic is the higher up you go on the threshold, this threshold is 21,800 rand a month, then effectively you have more negotiating power in respect of determining your own terms and conditions of employment. The issue around employment, and I think the Labour Relations Act amendment process coming out of NEDLAC now together with, of course, this inflation-related increase, not bigger, just needs to send the positive messages out there to employers to encourage them to employ. And again, for me, Jeremy, it's not about whether it's full-time, part-time, or any other employment. It's any employment at all. We need to get people into jobs, get them experience, and effectively from then they can get traction. And if they don't make it in the first 3 months, then you should have the ability to replace them with someone else who might want to be more timeous, might want to be more punctual, might want to be more attentive to detail. I think those things will make an impact on the job market. Beyond that, of course, we need to get the labor market institutions working, like UIF. To my mind, it's a shambles. And we see that in the parliamentary portfolio committees. The shambles, it's not well governed. There's a whole range of irregularities happening. And those are labor market levers where you're going through tough times, recession and otherwise. You can use those effectively, not for bad investments, not for the wrong reasons, but for the right reasons in terms of keeping businesses alive and keeping people employed.
Let me ask you more of a process-driven question, and I'm not 100% sure whether I've got this right. I don't run a company, but I'm assuming that many still struggle with the overall compliance costs. There's always regulatory red tape. Does this threshold increase, or does the threshold increase do anything to ease that burden, do you think?
I think it keeps it in line. So the real question is, do you need a threshold? I think you do, so that certain people are covered by extra basic conditions of employment and other people are not. But I think if you increase this above inflation each particular year, I think you'd run into trouble.
Also, we're seeing a change in the way in which business is done, the adoption of artificial intelligence. There's a whole lot more automation now. Do you think looking ahead, this threshold or the concept of the threshold impacts the future of jobs in an economy which is becoming increasingly digitized?
I don't think the threshold has any really effect on that. I think the real question is, are these people employees? So, Jeremy, you as an example, have a number of jobs. You don't have one particular employer, you're an independent contractor. And I think with digitalization, with the gig economy, I think we're going more and more to that. And I think labor law and UIF and all those systems will always battle to catch up with people who will have a number of jobs. I'll give you an example. So why do you need your own financial director? You could have one financial director working for five or six companies with the AI that's available in respect to processing accounts. And you're going to see that. You're not going to have your own financial director. The question is, that person might be an independent contractor and might very well be very happy being an independent contractor, not need any regulation of labor law. So not everyone needs to be protected by labor law.
I'm going to leave it there. Jonathan Goldberg, thank you very much indeed. Chairman, Global Business Solutions.
Top stories to keep your eyes and ears on.
Now, South Africa's constitution is often hailed as one of the most progressive in the world, but I wonder what this actually means in practice. In a country still grappling with deep social and economic inequality, can the law be a real tool for transformation or simply a document filled with lofty ideals? And here is the issue. Higher education institutions play a critical role in shaping the next generation of legal minds, and with that comes a responsibility to embed transformative constitutionalism into legal education, ensuring that graduates aren't just technically proficient, but also equipped to drive real change. I want to explore this in a little more detail. I'm in conversation now with Dr. Bronwyn Batchelor, head of the law faculty at the Independent Institute of Education. Bronwyn, a very warm welcome to you. So let's wade straight into it. Is our legal education system doing enough to produce lawyers who are not just simply practitioners, but as I've mentioned, advocates for justice and transformation?
So that's a very apt question, Jeremy. I think that is what we are actually trying to encourage our higher education institutions to look deeper into, because no longer is the legal profession just willing to accept graduates who have the theoretical knowledge but are not able to apply that knowledge in our constitutional framework, and to look for opportunities of actually transforming the environment around them. So I think there have been strides since the LLB standards were released a few years ago, but I still think there's a lot to be done in this space.
So fundamentally, what needs to change at the educative level?
So in order to inculcate transformative constitutionalism, we are saying that quite a few things need to be done. The fundamental level would be the curriculum. where we need to ensure that we're including social justice as a fundamental element. But also in the actual lecture room, we're talking about participation and inclusivity. The fact that students become a part of the curriculum that they are taught, and that it's actually something that is co-created by looking at case studies, the historical context of our constitution, the role of the judiciary, and then going beyond the classroom, which I think is the element that is maybe lacking in a few spaces, and looking at clinical programs, internships, and community engagement projects. We find that when students are able to engage with the real world challenges and social justice issues firsthand, the theory actually starts to make sense to them, and they can see where they fit in the equation of being able to make change.
So out of the classroom and in the real world, why is this mindset shift so important? What potential difference could it make to the practice of law in this country?
I think the difference is actually to the graduate, right? If we focus on the classroom and the environment and the cold curriculum, as we call it, without any color, we find that we are releasing graduates who are not holistic. And what I mean by that is they haven't yet received the skills and started to build on those that relate to social justice, the ability to interact with different people from different walks of life. They lack accountability and the understanding of transparency in decision making. So it really affects our graduates negatively if we don't have a holistic approach to our law academic programs.
Bronwyn, as someone who reported politics in the 1980s, I see similarities here, because it's difficult and often you need courage to challenge power structures. It's much easier, isn't it, to simply uphold the status quo. And I think what you're suggesting is we are in danger of producing lawyers who are going to do exactly that.
100%. I think you've hit the nail on the head. And the opposite to that, which we've also seen in our younger generation, is challenging the status quo, but doing so irresponsibly. I think what we are trying to advocate for is challenging the status quo responsibly within the parameters of our constitution. And that's actually what is transformative constitutionalism. And if we don't inculcate that in our students from the start, by encouraging them to think critically for themselves, to evaluate, to form their own opinions, and to measure that against our founding document, then we will be doing a disservice to the graduates and to the community at large.
What about the counter argument to that, that transformative constitutionalism distracts from the core function of legal education, and that is to provide competent and job-ready lawyers?
So I don't see them as being competing imperatives. I see it as the same imperative. Transformative constitutionalism not only teaches the fundamentals or the foundations of constitutional law, but how to actually actualize that. So it's something that you should see in every module within your law curriculum, with the capstone at the end of saying, okay, now how do we put this into action? So the fact that you're saying this is theoretical is actually the problem that we need to be addressing.
This isn't a problem, of course, unique to South Africa and our legal education system, is it?
I don't believe so, although obviously our focus is South Africa, and my niche area would be South African legal education, although it would be something that would be experienced in every country that has gone through some kind of political change that we saw in our past.
How do you convince young students that transformative constitutionalism is important in terms of the career path that they're following?
So that's an interesting question. In my space, we embarked upon this journey over the last 2 to 3 years, and we've actually found now in the last 12 months that they've caught the vision and their passion has been set on fire, and they are now initiating interventions with the community and coming up with all kinds of exciting things. And I think what caused that transition from an educator talking about it to a student wanting to engage with it was them beginning to realize how close to home it actually is. So that is where the real life becomes applicable. So bringing in the examples that are not just case studies and simulations, but helping them to realize that this is actually affecting your mother, your father, your brother, your sister, your colleagues. And we did that through a number of high-profile guest speakers coming onto our campuses, and that has really proven quite effective.
Dr. Bronwyn Batchelor, thank you very much indeed, head of the law faculty at the Independent Institute of Education. It's an important issue, and thanks for throwing some light on it.
Thank you for having me.
And that is our program for today, MoneyWeb at Midday. We are live at noon weekdays, then we're up as a podcast. Goodbye to you, and thank you for listening.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.